Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is brought to you by Telium, the universal data hub that connects your web, mobile, call center, in-store, and other data sources together with every vendor integration. Stay tuned to hear Telium's CMO, Adam Corey, chat with AdExchanger's Zach Rogers about collecting data with a centralized strategy to better know your customers and create more innovative experiences.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the program. This is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of AdExchanger, and I'm your host as well. It's good to be with you again. So for the people who use it, the social navigation app Waze inspires a great deal of loyalty. And for people who don't use it, it can inspire mockery from their children. That's what I experienced from my son when I use Google Maps instead of Waze. He was appalled recently that I did that. Waze is owned by Google, the app may at first seem to compete with its corporate sibling, Google Maps. But there are some striking differences, as we're about to learn. Company also has an interesting story to tell around brand partnerships, and we're going to talk about that too. I'm really pleased to have Susie Ryder, Waze's Managing Director, here in the studio to discuss these things with me. Welcome, Susie.
Thank you, Zach.
Great to have you. How are you?
I am very well.
Super.
So it's about 117 degrees here in New York City.
It's really uncomfortable.
It's warm.
Yeah. Our clothes are all sticking to us. But this podcast studio is nice and cool.
The podcast studio is quite lovely. And there was a lovely display of fruit as we walked in the door this morning, quite refreshing.
So I'd like to start out talking a little bit about you, just so the listener knows who you are, where you're coming from. Where do you hail from originally?
So I was raised in Boston, but my whole family is actually from San Francisco. My parents were raised in San Francisco. And in 1990, I was working for a Ziff Davis tech publication. I've always worked in tech. And the magazine, we closed up on a Friday and we opened back up on a Monday morning on the West Coast. So that was my big move west.
Okay, got it. And have you lived out there ever since?
Yeah, I've lived in San Francisco since 1990.
Okay.
Although many people think that I live in New York because I'm in New York all the time because the media business is here. So I spend a tremendous amount of time on the East Coast.
There's a little sliver of a media business in San Francisco.
I think there's a media tech business in San Francisco.
Okay, yeah.
But I always feel like Madison Avenue and the advertising agencies and kind of the heart and soul of advertising, I think, is still here in New York.
Right. So inevitably, over the course of your first years in San Francisco, a smart-driven person starts to gravitate towards the technology industry.
Towards tech. So I worked for Ziff Davis Publishing for 14 years. And for those who don't know, Ziff Davis was one of the great publishers of all time. And
iconic.
Totally iconic and really pioneered what special interest publishing was in the early days. So Ziff had boats like yachting, sailing, motorcycle. There was a bride magazine. So there were special interest publications and really—
There was a brides on motorcycles magazine. They went very niche.
Very niche. But it was the early days of, I mean, it was special interest publishing. So it was really understanding a core constituency, a core audience, and really understanding the categories and the primary advertisers that would be interested in those audiences. And then when I came to work for Ziff was during the tech era, we had a magazine called Computer Shopper that was like a couple phone books all stacked together because this was early 90s. This was pre-internet. So if you wanted to figure out what computer you should buy or what monitor or what mouse or what keyboard, you were actually using magazines like PC Magazine, PC Computing, PC Week, Computer Shopper to identify the innovation in tech.
Got it. So at what stage did you drift away from media and why?
So I worked for Ziff for for 14 years. And my last role at Ziff Davis was working on a stable of video game publications. So I may be a woman, but I am expert in the 18 to 34-year-old male audience, which was the audience that was reading all of the video game publications.
Right.
And this was early 2000. And all things interactive and internet were coming to be. And I moved from working on video game and computer gaming magazines to going to work for GameSpot.
Okay.
GameSpot.com. GameSpot.
So
it's a you know, cheats, tips, and codes for gaming.
Right.
And so I took everything I knew about the gaming industry and all of the relationships that I developed with the folks who run product and marketing for the game publishers and developers. Mm. And I moved to CNET Networks, which is now CBS Interactive, and took on leadership of a website called GameSpot. So it mm-hmm. was the digital version, mm-hmm. right? So, and it's still around today.
Okay.
So I was there at CNET for 4 years. I started just working on GameSpot, and my last job there was as the general manager of the entertainment division, which had a music property, a television property, and the gaming property.
Okay.
Right. And what was interesting about that was that there was a lot of community participation. So we used to call it architected participation, particularly with one property, which was TV.com. The product team built the framework, but it was really the community of people who would come in and give the updates on all of the shows. Mm. So there were these incredible kind of updates on what was happening with the shows. And I don't know if you remember this, Zach. This is early days, but there was an email that I think was written by a guy who worked at Oracle. This is early 2000s, and it was weekly updates of Melrose Place. And uh-huh. he would write like these unbelievable kind of updates of
like show recaps.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly, show recaps. And that was kind of the core of what was in this property, TV.com. Mm-hmm. So this sense of community and how communities participate in media is something that got me a little bit hooked early on and was useful thing to be thinking about as I joined the YouTube team in 2006.
Right. YouTube is so much about the community. And of course, Waze is as well, as we'll get to.
Yeah.
But okay, great. So, and what brought you to YouTube?
So it was early 2006. Mm-hmm. And there was this tiny little, I don't know what we'd even call it, website. It was called YouTube. It had, I don't know, I think it was like 20 million users when I first started interviewing with them. I think everybody in the Bay Area who did a job like I did as a essentially head of sales and head of media, lots of people had talked to this company. I went and interviewed with Chad and Steve, who were the founders of YouTube, in the spring and ended up joining the company the summer of 2006. And we were an independent company. There were about 30 of us. We were working out of a tiny office on the second floor in San Mateo. And it was everything that one could imagine about working at one of these, you know, in a startup environment where you came to work and there was boxes of tables on the side. You had to put your desk together, literally. Mm-hmm. You had to put your desk together before you had a place to sit. We had no conference rooms. I remember there was an elevator we didn't really use. And sometimes if you needed to have a conversation, a private conversation, you'd literally go into the elevator because there was nowhere.
Did you have an inkling at that time that this was a behemoth in the making? That
for sure.
It was heading for $10 billion in estimated ad revenue?
There was overwhelming momentum in the early days. It was so clear that the community and the user base was just moving so fast. And the way that the creator community at that point was beginning to use the platform was pretty incredible. And then the way that brand marketers were beginning to use the platform with a lot of guidance from us was pretty incredible too. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, I felt it in my heart when I first joined that this was going to be one of the greatest marketing platforms the world had ever seen.
Uh-huh.
And
then what happened for you after Google acquired them?
So I stayed. I mean, I don't know if this is confession, but
sure.
When we first came into Google, it was 2006. When I joined Google, Google was an AdWords search performance marketing company. So if you think about in those days, there was no Chrome. There was no Android. There was no real marketing.
They didn't have DoubleClick yet, did they?
No. DoubleClick hadn't been acquired yet. So it was really a performance marketing company.
It was a keyword company.
Yeah. And I had the title of chief marketing officer at YouTube. And I came in and I was given, what do you want to do? Do you want to go the marketing route or do you want to go the sales route? And Tim Armstrong was running the sales organization at the time. And I very quickly sussed out what kind of marketing does this company really understand marketing? A wonderful guy named David Loy, who now runs capital G at Google. Mm-hmm. But he was much more of a corporate development guy than a marketer. And that's who was running marketing at the time. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think I was going to stay. I thought I'd stay for 3 or 4 years and kind of play it out. And then what happened is I remember over time it was like the tone within the company shifted. And there was a tremendous amount of excitement and interest in this thing called the television marketplace, and both disrupting and enjoying the $120 billion-ish dollars that were flowing towards television and really YouTube's opportunity to really shift and change the way entertainment media was being consumed and the way brands were going to leverage this platform. So I ended up staying, and it's been great.
Yes, right. Yeah. And continues to be a vast opportunity for Google, which makes me wonder why you decided to then jump over to a much smaller app.
Yeah. So 12 years is a long time. So I'm pretty sure that it's the year 2018. And I joined in 2006 is when I joined Google. I've done a lot of really interesting jobs at Google. I ran the YouTube sales organization. I did some global strategy roles. I was part of the team that launched Brandcast, which is the upfront event, the first Brandcast, which was at the Beacon Theater. I was the person who got the project called Brand Lab, which is where we invite customers to come in and workshop what their brand experiences utilizing all the Google products are. So I had done a lot of really interesting things at Google. And then the last couple of years, I transitioned into a role running one of the industry teams, so running a team that was calling on the financial services sector, so the insurance companies and the big, you know, the J.P. Morgan Chases and the Capital Ones, but performance marketing. So that was a super interesting experience for me to actually be at the heart and soul of what is search in the year 2018, which is a pretty sophisticated proposition.
Right.
So I did that for a couple of years. And then I thought, you know, I've been here for 12 years. It's been an incredible experience. I feel so fortunate to have had the chance to work for Google. And I'm okay leaving. And there's some other things that I think I want to do and explore. And the Waze opportunity popped up. So I was thinking at that point that I would, you know, look around a bit outside the company and think about other opportunities. And then the Waze opportunity opened up, and it was
how does it
really
work? Was there an internal recruiter who knew you might leave or were restless? How does that work?
I had reached out to Noam, who is the Noam Barden, who is the chief Wazer. He has been at Waze almost from the beginning. And I had reached out to him a couple years before and invited him to come speak at an internal meeting that I was designing the agenda and the curriculum for. And he had come and he had talked a lot about the future of mobility. But I'd gotten to know him a little bit over time. And one of the challenging things about Google is that if you like to have national scope and scale, which is what I really enjoyed about my YouTube opportunities, it's hard to have that at Google unless you are in one of the tippy top jobs because everything is cut by vertical.
Right.
And so I saw Waze as an opportunity, again, to have national scope and also to have the kind of tight partnership with the product team that is really what drives me in these roles is to really help the product team and also the brand marketers figure out how to really use and leverage this platform. And that was really what I did at YouTube from the beginning.
Got it.
Really, how do you work with product to help them understand? I mean, they understand a heck of a lot, but help them understand the marketplace and what marketers are really after and looking for.
Okay.
And so I transitioned to Waze at the end of last year, but really kicked off the experience in January with a fascinating trip to Tel Aviv and to the desert, which is where Waze had its January meeting in a place called Alat.
Really? Okay. Great. So that's all wonderful background. I want to kind of jump into Waze and the app and its users. But first, we're going to hear from a sponsor real quick. I'll be right back with Susie Ryder. Hi, I'm back with Adam Corey, CMO at Telium, our sponsor. Adam, what's the value of a CDP? We hear that acronym a lot. And how does Telium fit into that space?
Yeah, CDPs or customer data platforms, they've really become a hot topic recently. And I think why they're so important is because companies really have a mandate to put customers at the center of their strategies. But if you take a peek inside of most companies today, you'll find that that's not necessarily happening. You know, analysts are looking at data differently than maybe an email marketing manager is. And they're doing that because they're basing their decisions off of different sets of data. And so with customer data being such a core component inside of an organization, it needs to be accessible. And that's really what a customer data platform is all about. It's the missing piece of most people's marketing stack that brings together the different technologies that are used by different teams and empowers everyone with the same set of customer data in real time.
All right, terrific. How does a company operationalize its data?
You know, it's funny because I think most companies are operationalizing their data today. Every team is using data to understand their part of the business, to build their own experiences, but they're doing it in silos. And so what needs to happen is we need to connect the understanding of what a customer cares about across each one of these teams. And we think with a customer data platform, it's really the rising tide that lifts all boats. When we think about how do I make use of this inside of my organization, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We're already doing this. We just need to connect the dots. And this is ironic because on the other side of the screen, customers are already omnichannel. Our data is already omnichannel. Everything is already there. We just need to connect the dots. And that's really what Telium wants to focus on.
All right. Every part of an organization seems to already have the ability to segment data in their existing tools. So why would a company need yet another segmentation tool? Why is this so hard?
Right. What do we need? Another tool for something else? I think when you dive into it, there's a ton of overlap that happens inside of marketing organizations today. You know, every team that works in every different channel is collecting their own data. They're reporting on their own data. They're segmenting their customers and their audiences out on their own terms. And it doesn't make sense for everyone to do this on their own over and over again. This is a core capability that everyone needs to bring from the center out to empower their teams. And if we think about it, what if instead of leaving it up to every team member to decide how they want to understand a customer, we simply connected their applications and their data sets together? Well, we'd first save a ton of time. We'd be creating better customer experiences. We'd understand our customers in a new and deeper way. And this also might change the way we buy technology for our businesses. You know, I don't necessarily need to go out and buy the Ferrari of applications every time. I really can think about what application would I buy if I could fuel it with the best data that I already have. I might change the way that I make some future investments.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Adam and Telium.
Thank you.
All right, and I'm back with Susie Ryder from Waze. So to a listener who is wondering, isn't Waze competitive with Google Maps? And why does Google maintain these two separate brands and platforms?
So I love that question, Zach. And yesterday, my daughter had been babysitting for an 8-year-old kid who said exactly the same thing, who said, isn't Waze owned by Google? And my daughter was explaining. So the way I think about it is, yes, Waze is obviously owned by Google. Waze does one thing, so it's a little like Kentucky Fried Chicken's old tagline, which was, we do chicken right. Mm-hmm. So Waze is for drivers. Waze is about traffic. Waze has a community of over 500,000 maps editors. It's all about drivers, all about traffic.
Okay.
Right? And comes from this community orientation. Google mm-hmm. Maps is an unbelievable product. It's got 1 billion users. Waze has 100 million users. And Google Maps is about navigating the physical world. So they're very different propositions. Mm-hmm. Google Maps, the orientation of the user is often search, whereas with Waze, the orientation of the user is usually, you know, it's a navigation app. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sometimes I laugh because people will say they've used Waze walking, and I'll say that's not what we're for. You know, we're for drivers, and we're about traffic.
Right.
You know?
I mean, Maps doesn't inspire a lot of conversation. I think Maps is a utility in our lives.
Yeah, and it has public transportation and it has transit and it has guides. And now when you use Google Maps, if you go to a restaurant, it'll ask you all these questions afterwards. If you want to be a Maps guide, do they have a handicapped bathroom?
Right.
Is it a good place for a date? You know, they'll ask you a series of questions as they're mm-hmm. building the knowledge graph and all of the data about the places that Maps takes you to. But they're very, very different feelings when they're using the products.
Right. And Waze is fun.
Waze is super fun. And I find that people either use Waze, swear by Waze, love Waze, won't get in the car without Waze, or they've never heard of it. You know, so there's a real passion for the product and it's super fun.
Right. So there's this also this dedication and loyalty that it inspires with users. Is that just about the fact that it's fun or what's feeding into
so
that?
It's community. So one of the things, so there are a bunch of things that I didn't realize about Waze until I started working here. So one of the reasons that the maps on Waze are so accurate is because there are 500,000 maps editors. And the way this works, okay, is it's almost like being in an actual, like if you're a maps editor, it's a little like being in a video game, except it's real. Mm. So they go out and they drive and they'll see things. So they'll see a road closure or a bridge closure, or they will see, like, for instance, in a shopping center, if the address of Best Buy is one thing, but the entrance of Best Buy might be another thing. Mm-hmm. So they'll note things, and then they'll go home and they'll actually edit the map. And there are maps editors who have a boundary. You know, they have an actual area that they are accountable for. And all of the maps editors in a certain area all level up to the kingpin maps editor, who is like the community manager of that region.
Okay.
And a couple times a year, we will actually have community meetups for our maps editors. And I went to one in San Francisco at the beginning of the year, and it was fascinating. I mean, I felt a little, again, like I was a very different version of being at YouTube with the creator community.
Yeah.
So these guys, first of all, they do it for free. And it was, I sat at a table for dinner. The gentleman sitting next to me, he was so funny. He was a retired mechanical engineer. And he said he spends 7 or 8 hours a day editing maps. And when he hears his wife's footsteps down the hall, like, right, that he quickly closes down his browser as though he may be doing something that she wouldn't appreciate him doing. But what he's doing is he's closing ways because he spends so much time.
Right.
But it's an obsessive,
it's a passionate hobby for many people. Yeah.
Super passionate hobby for people who are cartographers or engineers who,
wow. I mean,
it's just, so we have over 500,000 of these people and they keep the maps current and they make corrections. And that's why the Waze maps are so accurate.
It occurs to me that with many apps in our lives, there is an implicit value exchange. I'm giving my data to the app. I get to use the app for free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for so many different experiences, including Google's primary search and many, many, many others. It's your data and your attention, of course.
Yeah.
Now, with Waze, it seems to be, to me, that value exchange is more explicit. People are, like, they're consciously sharing. They're actively sharing.
That's right. You're participating in the community. And okay, so here again, I was driving with my daughter, who's 20, and we were driving down to San Jose yesterday. What was that? Labor Day. We were driving down to San Jose, and there was the little icon of a policeman. And as we're passing it, she's chiding me, Mom, hit it. Meaning I was the passenger, she was the driver, to note that, yes, thumbs up, there was a policeman.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so there's a sense of responsibility, I think, that you want to participate and you want to be feeding into the community. And that's a huge part of what Waze is all about. So as you say, Zach, there's this implicit sense that you're getting a value, but they use the app for free. But I think on Waze, people feel that they also need to contribute back and participate in the community.
Oh, yeah. I love that. We're all just helping each other be complicit and breaking the law. That's a beautiful thing. I'm just kidding. I actually love the cop feature.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. There are other things that Waze does that I think a lot of people don't know that we do. A woman on my team this past week participated in something with the city of Chicago and with a company called Spot Hero. Mm. And they literally installed a couple hundred beacons in tunnels and underground areas where if you're using GPS, your signal drops.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they had community members, you know, coming out in ways participates a lot with the municipalities and with the cities.
Yes, right. Yeah, it's that's a great service.
Yeah.
And I think with the police, I actually do. I do sometimes feel bad for these state patrol cars that have to move way more often than they used to.
Because we all know where they are.
We all know where they are. Within 30 seconds of them pulling up into what seems like a secluded spot. You know what? We better talk about brands and advertising because we don't have a ton of time left and the listeners are going to want to hear about it. So let me ask a very big picture question. Advertising on Waze. What is there? What do you all offer?
So advertising on Waze, we have what we call pins, which are the branded pins that are on the map. There are never more than three pins on the map at any given time. They are, you know them, you see them. People tease that mostly they see the Dunkin' Donuts pins, and Dunkin' Donuts is one of our biggest partners.
Okay.
And then
is that a long-standing partnership with Dunkin'?
We're phenomenal partners.
Okay.
So they've been with us for a long time. But the other ad unit that you will see, I didn't know this till I started working at Waze, but it's called the Zero Speed Takeover. So it's that takeover that comes up. It's zero speed because it comes up only when you're stopped for 3 seconds.
Mm.
That's it.
Okay.
And then when you start to drive, it'll go away again.
Makes sense.
Yep. So those are the two key ad units there. We have a change car unit, which is kind of fun. And if you look today, you'll see an opportunity to change to a Miata. And so you can change your car. So Mazda Miata is one of the cars that you can see driving around on the map.
Mm-hmm.
We also have change voice. So you might have heard last Christmas we had Santa Claus. It was very cute. It was like, ho, 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 is that a red light or is that Rudolph's nose? So that was kind of cute. We had Morgan Freeman. We had Liam Neeson promoting his
associated with promotions for their films.
Exactly, their films. Yeah. So the change voices are kind of fun, and it's a great way for entertainment companies or anybody who has a spokesperson and a voice.
Yeah.
Those promotions can be really fun.
Okay, great. And talk a little bit about sort of how you think about your advertising opportunity from a verticals point of view.
So
which industries are the best partners for you?
So the industries that are the best partners, Zach, are the ones, they're the obvious ones. I mean, what are we doing when we're driving
retail
around in our cars?
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's QSR, it's retail, it's fuel.
Uh-huh.
You know, those are the we do also, of course, we do business with entertainment and automotive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the Waze does one thing incredibly well, which we have the power to drive people to locations.
Mm-hmm.
So we drive people to curbside, drive-through, front door. That's what we do. And we do it incredibly well.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
But that is the value proposition for brands.
Well, you have a lot of data on location. Therefore, you can also demonstrate outcomes, I would think.
We have a lot of location data. It's all anonymized, but we can share really interesting insights. So we can show a big retailer, we know, do people go to the gym and then go get coffee?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we
can you then turn that into a segment?
We can.
Of gym and coffee lovers?
Well, we have segments of, we call them hungry Wazers, you know, people who go eat more than other people.
They're driving? Is that the kind of thing?
Eating while they're driving?
Well, I'm just trying to, I mean, everybody eats about the same amount, don't they?
Yeah, but not everybody drives and stops. And, you know, we know when people go to the grocery store. I mean, we know where people go.
There are some people who stop they're regular restaurant eaters, basically. They don't cook at home as much.
Yeah.
We can deduce.
So we know that. We know people who go to the grocery store versus people who go out to eat versus people who go QSR versus people who go for coffee twice a day or once a day.
That's a lot of data. Are you using it?
So we have massive amounts of data, and one of the things that I've been really interested in working on since I've gotten to Waze is working with our business analytics team and our data scientists and analysts to figure out how to get more of the interesting data out of the systems so that we can see it more easily and surface it for marketers and brands more easily.
How much are you relying on Google's centralized ad platform?
So Waze actually
services.
Runs on its own ad platform. So we have our own server, our own ad platform.
Interesting.
And that was, the company's been around for over 9 years. We came into Google about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the technology and the ad serving to really serve pins on maps, the folks who are running the ad operations team and all of the ad tech and the infrastructure really saw that we needed to develop our own capability to serve these things in the right way.
It's a completely unique kind of...
It's a different beast.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So do you think that will continue into the future? Do you see a big integration with Google's ad platform?
No, I mean, we really do run as a separate company. So we are not an Alphabet company, but we're like a Google bet. So Noam, who is my boss's boss, reports up into Sundar.
I see.
So we're under Google. But we really do run as our own entity.
Okay. Got it.
Which is kind of fun too. I mean, there aren't that many places within Google where you're actually running a business and running your own P&L. And
Right. No, it's completely, well, I don't know if it's, I'm sure there are other examples, but it's unique to my knowledge. So in terms of your ad sales operation, you said Dunkin' is a great partner. I'm sure you have a lot of others, and as you say, in these categories, QSR and
retail. Subway, Dunkin', Starbucks, Target, Walmart. I mean,
are they open-ended relationships or define, or generally speaking, or are they campaigns with a defined beginning and end date? In other words, are they ongoing?
Yeah. At Google, we use the term, I mean, the term used in search is always on.
Always on.
Right. Yeah. So some of the campaigns are always on because you think about it, there are always people driving around looking for gas, shopping, looking for food. Mm-hmm. So some of the campaigns are always on. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this business is still very flighted.
Okay. Got it. And how do you structure your sales?
So we have a national sales organization. We're not verticalized.
Okay.
I don't think verticalization is something that, I mean, Google is verticalized and Facebook is verticalized. And I think Twitter just verticalized a couple of years ago. But I think it's interesting at this stage of a business for the salespeople to call on different types of accounts. And then, of course, they're able to bring learnings from retail back to QSR and learnings from QSR, you know, to fuel. And really what this team is expert in is location-based marketing and location-based measurement. And also we talk a lot and know a lot about the future of mobility and transportation in cities.
Right.
And that's been a really interesting angle for me too. Just kind of the intellectual piece of it is really imagining and understanding and learning about, you know, self-driving cars and autonomous vehicles and the future of transportation.
How humans move.
Yeah, which is what, I mean, that's what Waze is. It's a human movement company. That's what the company is. And it's a human movement company. And on the ad side, we have the power to move people to locations.
With such a colossal amount of data, I'm sure there are all kinds of parties and cohorts out there who would love to license the data and use it in different ways, from city planners to people at Google who want to like improve their attribution for large advertising campaigns. Hey, this person drove past an out-of-home, a billboard. Can we get a confirmed sort of impression from ways that we can feed that into an attribution system? What's your approach to allowing your data set to be used outside of the Waze system?
On the community side, we work with cities, we work with municipalities, and if you're interested, it's the Connected Citizens Project, so you can understand what it is that we do with cities to share data, to understand things like peak traffic times and congestion and parking and all of those types of things. So that's all incredibly valuable to city planners. On the other side of it, we don't do a lot of that. So we share anonymized data and insights back with brand marketers.
Specifically your own advertisers. It doesn't get fed into like Google Analytics 360.
No.
Or something like that.
No.
Okay, got it. And programmatic, is there any story to tell there, or is it it's just not the right fit?
No, so you can buy Waze through DBM. Uh-huh. So that was something our product team worked on last year, and that capability now exists. So we do have programmatic opportunities on the platform.
Okay. When you turned on programmatic through DBM, did you notice an uptick in demand flowing in?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. When you're on my side of the business, ask any publisher, is it new money or is it the same money
just coming in a different way?
Just coming in through a different way. So I think it's important to have, because there are brands and marketers who really need to and require.
They want to transact that way.
They want to transact and they want programmatic opportunities. So we have that for the brands that need it.
Got it. Great. Yeah. And talk a little bit about the future. What opportunities do you have? What's on the roadmap?
So one thing that's interesting, if you watch what's happening with Americans and our disinterest in getting out of our cars, okay? So look at what Walmart is doing with their online grocery pickup. Mm-hmm. They've got a television campaign, you know, that shows the guy wakes up in the morning and he's while his family's still sleeping, he never gets dressed. He orders his groceries and he goes to Walmart and they get put in the trunk of his car and he drives home and, you know, unpacks them and is making pancake breakfast for his family. Target is being very aggressive with their drive up, you know, with their app and drive up that you, again, you don't have to get out of your car. So it reminds me a little of growing up in the 70s at the Stop and Shop near my parents' house where they would have those, you know, the rickety conveyor belts and they would put the grocery bags in the bins and you'd get your numbers and you'd go out and they'd give you your groceries. So we're back to. Okay, so Americans who we don't want to get out of our cars. So Waze has the opportunity because we know the arrival time and we're really excited about working on custom integrations with big retailers. You can imagine also with pharmacies for drive-through when to have prescriptions ready because, again, we know the arrival time that there could be integration into the Waze app so that you don't have to leave the Waze app and you can do a planned drive and you could do all of that activity within the Waze app. So we think of that as a custom integration. It's like curbside pickup, a planned drive. So that's an opportunity that we're interested in pursuing and working on with big retailers.
Okay.
Right? And you can imagine that for other categories. So for fuel, buy the gas on your phone and get $2 off of the convenience store. So, and that was, I think, one of the things that attracted me to this opportunity was the chance to really work on these types of custom integrations.
Very cool. All right. Well, gosh, I'd like to continue, but we're going to have to leave it there. What a great conversation. Susie Ryder, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you, Zach.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in to yet another episode of AdExchanger Talks. We'll see you next week.
Visit Tealium.com/AdExchanger to learn more about how Tealium is helping companies intelligently orchestrate customer data. Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.